Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
And welcome to the final CapEx podcast of the weird and not particularly wonderful year that has been 2020. And it's only fitting that we should be recording this over a Zoom channel, shorn of the warmth of personal contact by the iniquities of the Rona, which I realise sounds a bit like a Tolkien novel. Anyway, for our final rundown of 2020 and our awards, I'm delighted to be joined by our deputy editor, Alice Denby.
Hello.
And from the Institute of Economic Affairs, the wonderful Emma Revel.
Hi, John.
And last but not least, salad impresario and competition guru, Sam Bowman, who is director of competition at the International Centre for Law and Economics. I think I got that right.
Well, I always get it wrong, but you've beaten me to it. So hello.
There we go. All right. So without much further ado, we're going to have a list of various different categories. Everyone's going to choose their one. And our first category is moment of the year. Alice, we'll start with you. What was your moment of the year?
My favourite moment of this year was when the SNP MP Margaret Ferrier travelled from Scotland down to London with COVID symptoms, having already taken a test. She then found out she was positive and took the train back up to Glasgow. And she said later in an interview that coronavirus makes you act out of character. I wasn't aware that was one of the main symptoms. Basically, I just love how flagrant she was, not just flouting the rules and basic common sense, but refusing to resign, even when Nicola Sturgeon called on her very strongly to do so. And she's still an MP to this day, and I just think, good on her.
Yeah, I think if one thing characterises the Scottish nationalists, it's not nationalism, it's just not giving a crap what anyone else thinks of what they do, and then just ploughing on. Sam, what was yours?
Mine is kind of not funny. It's boringly sincere. It's the Pfizer vaccine announcement, which basically was the kind of the beginning of the end. And, you know, waking up that Monday morning and seeing that we had not just a 70% or 60% efficacy vaccine, as I think I and most other people had expected, but a 90% efficacy or better efficacy vaccine. I mean, it really, it's just changed everything. And it just means that this pretty awful year is going to end more or less at the end of the year or early next year, and we can get back to normal, get back on with our lives. And it's really a kind of testament to science and capitalism, fact that we have not just one now, but several vaccine candidates, many more being tested and coming online. And at the kind of time we're recording this, more than 100,000 people have already been vaccinated in the UK. It's really kind of amazing. And also, it makes me somewhat proud, although I'm not particularly patriotic in any way, but somewhat proud that the country I've chosen to live in, the UK, has been the first in the world to test the vaccines and approve them for widespread use. And that's pretty cool.
Yeah, I think that's a very good choice. I also really like the fact that as soon as Pfizer came out with theirs, the Russian government decided to come and say that Sputnik, is it V or 5? I don't know. Has an even higher efficacy rate than Pfizer, although we're not allowed to see any of the data or trials or anything like that. But I'm pretty sure it's fine. My own one is in a similar vein to Sam's. We'll come to Emma's in a minute because hers, I have to say, is probably my favourite. Mine is when Boris came on TV back in March and did this sort of solemn, almost wartime address about lockdown, where it was like, must stay at home. And it was just bizarre seeing this this sort of normally jocular, slightly whimsical character suddenly shifting tone so dramatically, and also just telling us all to stay in for weeks and weeks on end. And everyone just kind of going along with it, whether you agree with it or not. It was very, there was very little kind of kickback to essentially being told by the government that you can't leave your house, which I guess I find in hindsight quite concerning that people have that little regard to their own liberty.
Maybe they have regard for their own health. Remember, health and liberty are both very valuable things.
I should stress at this point, I'm not really like a lockdown skeptic. It just surprised me how quiescent people were. There were tiny little protests, but not much more. But speaking of liberty, Emma's moment of the year. Oh no, that was your hero of the year. But I think moment of the year was. My
moment of the year is still about freedom. You know, yeah. It was still a day I enjoyed. I mean, Sam has been a proper serious grown up as he is and picked the moment that it genuinely did start to end and we had a vaccine and, you know, everything goes back to normal. I picked the moment where it felt like that was true, even though with hindsight it wasn't. And that was the 4th of July when the pubs reopened. I'm not a massive fan of pubs. I don't drink. So, you know, pubs to me are sort of a place where I stand and drink a Diet Coke while everyone else has a great time. But I was in the pub at 10 o'clock in the morning, full work, I might add. I didn't just rush out. I was doing some live radio.
Was that with Mike Graham and people?
Yes. Yeah. Talk radio live stream, 3 hours, live from
there
the pub.
There is a man who does like the pub.
He does. I mean, when he said he was going to do a live stream from a pub, I thought, yeah, I'm not surprised by that at all. Yeah. But they said, you know, come join us, do your 10 minutes on air talking about the economics of lockdown and why it's great that pubs have reopened. But by the way, we are going to stay here all day and just keep drinking and have a great time. And, you know, it was wonderful. It was the most normal thing I'd done in 4 or 5 months. You know, I got properly dressed up. I didn't just sit around the house in the newly bought loungewear. So, it, you know, in hindsight, was it a great idea? Probably not. And it didn't pan out as well as I'd hoped. But in that day, it was a really great moment to just see people getting back to normal, getting back to pubs, seeing friends.
Yeah, we will come on to the kind of slightly catastrophic policies of the summer in due course. But our second category, one I quite enjoy, we've all chosen quite different things here, is Hero of the Year. So, Sam, do you want to kick us off? Who is your hero of 2020?
Yeah, and I should say, kind of looking at other people's choices for all of these categories, I'm the kind of boring, serious one, choosing the... trying to kind of make this about money and finance, but my hero of the year, always, that's me. My hero of the year is the Federal Reserve's chairman, Jay Powell, and his money printer going burr. It's absolutely phenomenal what the Federal Reserve has done. It's bought $3 trillion worth of assets in just 1 year, less than a year, bringing, you know, almost doubling the Fed's balance sheet. And that includes all of the asset purchases throughout the 2010s, during the Great Recession and so on. And it's absolutely staggering how successful it's been. You know, personal expenditures are where they were 14 months ago after having shut down huge parts of the US economy. In almost any other situation, we would expect this to create an absolutely catastrophic long-term recession or depression. And the use of monetary policy in line really with what Milton Friedman and other monetarist economists predicted and recommended, the use of monetary policy to offset that that contraction obviously hasn't meant that we're not any poorer, but has meant that the kind of knock-on effects, which can be even more disastrous, may have been largely avoided and may be largely avoided. And it's not just good for this, it's not just good for the recovery as we come out of this, but it means that we may have learned, not if not how to cure recessions in the future, but how to make them much less severe.
All right. So that was a very serious one, Sam, but we've got to have some, you know, add some intellectual heft to our more banter heavy answers. Alice, yours is pretty serious as well. Sam's gone for one individual who's kind of at a high ranking position. You've gone for something quite different.
Yeah, I mean, my choice now feels a bit corny after that kind of serious policy one, but I've gone for the vaccine volunteers, people who volunteered to take a completely untested new drug and then basically had to go out and get the virus. I just think they've saved the world. And thanks very much.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much. I'm going in on Friday for mine. I'm going to be part of one of the vaccine trials on Friday. Yeah.
I'm in the ONS testing trial.
That's much more unpleasant because you have to have a rod stuck up your nose every couple of minutes.
I also have to stick a rod up my 2-year-old daughter's nose.
Which, oh, I thought you were going to say something completely else.
It's not something there. She enjoys one bit. It's an absolute shambles, though. Like, they don't tell you they're coming until midnight or something the day before, and then you're like, "Well, I'm not in." Oh, reschedule.
So they do it in person. They do it in person.
Yeah they come.
Wow. Well, I assumed it was all done remotely with Amazon or something.
You can do it, and then they'll pick it up, but they have to come round and give it to you, the sample, the first time. It's not absolutely terrible. It's just quite terrible. So, like a lot of the British response.
Could be worse, but definitely could be better.
It could be better. Again, I think Emma's got the answer that is a really good finisher for this category. My hero of the year is also quite a serious one, and it's apologies to any Chinese speakers. Li Wenliang, who was the doctor in Wuhan who raised the alarm about COVID, was silenced and then died of the disease. I just think a phenomenally brave person, and also a totem of all the worst practices of the Chinese Communist Party and what they have. I mean, we can talk about Western countries' responses, and we've done them to death, but I think at the risk of sounding a bit earnest, you shouldn't lose sight of the villainy of the Chinese government and what they've inflicted on the rest of the world by trying to hide the vaccine in the first place. On which note, Emma's hero of the year.
You can't then pivot to me. This is so unfair.
About a guy on a jet ski.
People are going to think I haven't taken this seriously at all. And I have. I worked really hard on my answers. But I've still gone for my hero in kind of a social media sense of he's a complete legend. And that's Dale McLaughlin, who is from North Ayrshire and was working pre-COVID in the Isle of Man. Met a very nice girl, started dating. He had to go back. Then the Isle of Man, because it had so few cases, put massive restrictions on. He really missed his girlfriend and decided to rent a jet ski, despite the fact
he didn't. Even better. Well,
either way, he'd never been on one in his life. He thought the 25-mile or so journey would take about 45 minutes. It took him 4 hours. But he jet skied to the Isle of Man and then had to apparently walk for several miles to his girlfriend's house, based on where he landed, because he really missed her. And I thought that was lovely. I mean, we should be obeying restrictions. You probably shouldn't be jet skiing across large bodies of water. But in the internet definition of a hero in 2020, he's ticked the box for me.
A four-hour jet ski over the Irish Sea is punishment enough, I think.
He's now in jail, so...
One of the worst things you could possibly do to yourself.
Walk on the jet ski.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. It sounds like a living hell. I hate that kind of. I hate being on the water anyway. So that really would.
I read when you submitted your answer, Emma. I looked it up, and apparently, what I loved is that the girlfriend thought he'd been on the Isle of Man for 2 weeks anyway.
Yes. Apparently, when the police caught them, she said, "Oh well, I thought he was just working elsewhere on the island, and we hadn't seen each other." Denied our knowledge of the jet ski.
Well, and I should add, he was imprisoned for doing
that. He's in jail. Ridiculous. Like, I mean, because he broke the rules, but
yeah,
his dedication to maintaining social contact during a pandemic, I have a little bit of respect for.
Yeah, I think if you're going to do it, go the whole hog. Right.
I don't want to put this into the gutter, but do you think she, made it worth his while?
Well, I don't know how long he was there between arriving and getting caught, but if they had the chance, I really, really hope so. If not, she should when he gets out.
Sure. I don't know if he's been released yet. Anyway, we'll have to find out. Dale McLaughlin, everyone. I think he's my hero of heroes, actually. Okay, from
here. Get in touch, Dale, if you...
Dale, if you do listen to the CapEx podcast, then get in touch. Our villain of the year. We have some very villainous characters here. Alice, we'll kick off with you. A titan of British retail.
Yes, well, I mean, I think probably the Chinese Communist Party has done more global harm this year. But for me personally, Sir Philip Green is my villain of the year. Topshop was the iconic brand of my teenage years, and he's just allowed it to completely be swallowed up. He's completely failed to keep up with what consumers actually want. So other brands like ASOS and Primark have completely taken over. And he just also comes across as a really gross, horrible man who constantly just gets photographed with his arm around supermodels, and I just think he seems like an asshole. So he's my villain of the year.
Tell us what you really think. There was also a brilliant photograph where Philip Green had been really rude to the photographer. So the photographer decided to photograph him with two small bushes either side, which made him look like a giant penis, which I thought was very funny indeed.
Oh, and I should mention the obviously the Topshop employees whose jobs and pensions he's completely screwed over.
Yeah. It's not the first green business that's gone south either. So from one villain to another. Sam, yours is more COVID-y.
Yeah, I actually started doing my list saying I don't want to do any COVID. We had a really COVID heavy year, but it pretty much is the most important thing that's happened in my life, apart from maybe the fall of the Berlin Wall. And it's hard to get away from it. So I apologize for being so monomaniacal. My villain of the year is actually more of a kind of idiot of the year. The villains are the people who listen to her. So the idiot of the year is Sunetra Gupta, the Oxford academic, who in March said that 50% of the UK may have already had COVID, according to a model that she generated without any actual data. In May said that COVID was behind us and that it may have an IFR, an infection fatality rate, of 0.01%, which would mathematically have required the UK to have a population of 360 million people and for everybody, literally everybody, to have had it already. She was completely undeterred by that, by being wrong, led the Great Barrington Declaration, which I think has suckered a lot of people into thinking that there are easy answers to COVID. All of that is, there's nothing wrong with being wrong, there's nothing wrong with being dumb, but the villains really are the people who listen to her. And the Sunday Times this weekend reported that she had been invited into Downing Street in September and that she was one of the people who had convinced the Prime Minister not to lock down in September and to lock down much later, which I think with hindsight was a really, really big mistake. It's really, really shocking to me that she keeps getting taken seriously and that her kind of cohort of cranks keep getting treated as if they really know what they're talking about by anybody.
I think it's a sort of object lesson in any, if you can stick Oxford University in front of your name, people will listen to you regardless of what you're actually saying. There are other kind of totemic figures you might have picked. I know Anders Tegnell, for example, might have been one. He's the Swedish.
Yeah, the Swedish chief epidemiologist. Yeah, and it's hard to know what's really going on there. I read a great piece on one of my favorite websites, CapEx, the other day, that by a Swede that argued that really what looks to the outside world like a kind of liberal decision, the decision that it's just really not right to impose lockdowns on people and let people make decisions for themselves, is actually more likely explained by bureaucratic incompetence. And the Swedish state is very interestingly set up. Unlike most countries where public agencies effectively answer to the government, in Sweden, public agencies have a huge amount of autonomy, and it's very, very difficult for the government to override them on a lot of decision-making. And it's kind of like a technocrat's dream. And I am very, very sympathetic to technocracy. I'm very, very sympathetic to the idea of, tying the hands of politicians and letting supposed experts make decisions. But this is a real, I really have to say I've significantly adjusted my views of technocracy by looking at Sweden and what happens when somebody with a really bad idea who's very, very attached to that idea gets to really do whatever they want with no public constraint at all.
Yeah, and we'll come onto the idea of adjusting views in our next segment, Sam, because one of your answers is very closely linked to that. But anyway, villain of the year, another COVID-y one, and a slightly different tag. Emma, you've gone for, I think, someone from the World Health Organization.
Yeah, Dr. Tedros Adhanom, who's the Director General of the World Health Organization. This category I did take very seriously, by the way. Who, you know, basically the World Health Organization are the premier global organization who are supposed to handle and coordinate international responses to pandemics. And they failed. They've categorically failed at basically every stage. You know, at the beginning of the year, when we already knew that we were seeing infection clusters in China, Taiwan raised a number of concerns saying, you know, we've heard reports of this, we've started to see one or two infections, should we be doing something? The World Health Organization basically ignored Taiwan completely and have sidelined Taiwan all the way through, presumably to maintain good relationships with China. As a result, you know, the information that Taiwan had that could have been passed on to the rest of the world very quickly was completely ignored. They criticized travel bans against China, saying that it would create fear and stigma that was worse than the virus. I think we all know that's not true. They criticized the use of face masks and said they were ineffective. The World Health Organization has spent the last sort of 5-10 years focusing almost exclusively on lifestyle economics. You know, they're focused on universal healthcare, gender inequality. And whether or not you agree that these are important issues, that is not the primary focus of the World Health Organization. It is pandemics and infectious diseases, and they have, you know, fundamentally dropped the ball, while at the same time as cozying up to China, who I think we can all agree, you know, are a repulsive regime in charge. And yet, Tedros Adhanom praised China's commitment to transparency in the early stages of the pandemic. I mean, you know, if they had been transparent, we'd probably have coped a hell of a lot better than we have, because we'd have known exactly how this disease was transmitted. Whereas actually in January, the World Health Organization said that there was no evidence of human to human transmission.
Yeah, I slightly push back on that. I agree with you. The WHO has been terrible, but I think you're being a little bit too kind to Western governments here, because we did have a lot of knowledge about how it was transmitted. We did have a lot of knowledge about how bad it was. I mean, Italy had a first wave long before the case numbers were large enough in the UK, for example, that we wouldn't have been able to act swiftly and stop it and nip it in the bud, as, you know, Norway and Denmark did at in the first wave. And I really don't believe that Western governments would have done very much differently, because when they did have that information, they didn't do anything differently. And
I mean, that's very true. You know, we've performed really badly with the information we did have. And, you know, if we'd had that information 3 months earlier, we may have still made the same terrible decisions, but we'd have at least had 3 months of a head start in which to, you know, fuck it up.
3 months of terrible decisions.
Right. So I'm from China, sorry, from a bit of China bashing from Emma, I'm gone. My villain of the year is the China basher in chief, Donald Trump. It's a bit of a boring choice. I've gone for him for villain more in a kind of pantomime villain sense, because there's been a kind of air of total predictability about the way that he has behaved since the election. And it's his kind of commitment to the shtick that I find so remarkable. I expected a bit in the sort of week or so after. I didn't expect still, you know, more than a month after the election result, him to still be banging on about it and talking about how he doesn't get to make his case in the Supreme Court or anything. And I do think that actually, on a serious note, what he's done has, for a large amount, has made an already extremely polarized society even more so. That wasn't very articulate of me. He's made a lot of his supporters believe that elections, that the democracy isn't real, that elections are rigged. And the great irony may be that the Republicans end up losing the Georgia Senate because some Trump heads don't go out and vote because they think it's all a fix, which would kind of be a perfect ending to it all for me. So, yeah, I've gone with him, and good riddance, frankly.
I have to say, though, as somebody who bets on politics, I've been very grateful for all the deluded idiots betting against me, and I've been able to significantly increase my winnings in the months
since. Have you got your money yet, Sam?
Yeah, it came through today. So
wow. I
donated 10% to charity, and I encourage all of my fellow bettors to donate 10% of their winnings to charity as a tithe. It buys an indulgence so that when you're being weighed up, you go into heaven. Having paid a tithe of your winnings, it nullifies the sin that is betting. So it's good for you and good for the world.
Well, excellent. I think that's a lovely festive message, Sam.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Right. So we've had heroes, villain. We now come to a slightly more abstract category, which is idea of the year. And then we're going to have policy of the year. These are a little bit similar. So idea of the year can kind of, you can interpret that as loosely as you want, whereas policy of the year is generally kind of a British government policy. So idea of the year. Emma, do you want to kick us off here?
I mean, I feel really bad going first because I stole this idea off Alice because I couldn't think of anything else. And I thought, oh, that's a good idea. I'll just put that too, which was very bad of me. But she's thought of other things, so that's fine. Despite earlier saying that I didn't massively enjoy pubs and I don't drink, I am still able to appreciate the joy that is the takeaway pint and the normalisation of a takeaway pint. I think for over the summer when I was meeting up with friends in parks outside in groups of less than six, the fact that they could go to the pub and support the pub as opposed to, you know, buying probably arguably cheaper beers from a supermarket, you know, they really wanted a draft pint. And the fact that it came in a plastic cup with a lid, well, they were willing to live with that. It's enabled businesses to keep running. You know, it's not going to be enough to save them, but it's better than nothing. And it did bring a sense of normal for that brief period in the summer when the weather was nice, we could all be outside and see friends. So I think that's a win. I hope it stays.
Now we're in tier three. A lot of my local pubs in Southeast London are doing a sort of click and collect system. So they've basically just got their Wi-Fi and their website kind of outside. You go and you get on your phone and you fill out a form. And then, I mean, it's ludicrous that pubs are having to do this, but you have to really admire the innovation. Yeah. They're doing everything they can to stay open, even in these mad circumstances. And
I think more broadly as well, you know, relaxing the rules about whether or not you have to have a certain kind of planning permission before you can do takeaway food. You know, that has been so important for businesses and, you know, small restaurants and cafes to keep going during the pandemic. And the fact that that regulation was ever needed is bonkers. And I really hope it doesn't return.
Yeah, I mean, the saying takeaway pints is your idea of the year sounds on the surface a little bit like jocular, but it is a kind of one of a whole category of things that businesses have had to do. And it's been pretty amazing to see how well they've adjusted. And as you said as well, the government managed to change some things really, really quickly, such as Robert Jenrick changing the laws on pubs allowing to open. We'll come on to the other policies in due course. But yes, it's been a year of not just despair, but also great innovation. So, Alice, what was yours when you've dispensed with pints, as Emma's taken that off you? So what's your...
So I went a bit meta with this one, and my idea of the year is the science. So the very concept that ideas themselves can actually solve our problems, I think it's a bit of a huge pivot from having had enough to experts to now thinking that scientists have all the answers when, in fact, on loads of aspects of this virus, the science is very unclear and it's kind of guesstimates, but we now think that the science, just follow that and we'll be all right. So I think that's quite a change in the culture.
Okay, I'm with you on that. I've written a few columns on the idea of the science. It's a phrase that also that Greta Thunberg really loves to say. It's if there's this
just entirely unimpeachable body of knowledge. Again, I should stress, I don't disagree with climate change. I just disagree that it's one single thing that we should just react in a certain way to without any assessment of costs or benefits, which is kind of similar to how it's been presented in this year as well. Sam, yours is also to do with kind of judgment. And it's something that's got a bit of an unfairly bad rep from certain corners of the commentariat. So what's your idea?
My idea actually is very related to Alice's. The big idea is the idea of super forecasting, but actually the idea is forecasting in general. And what I mean by that is holding people to account for their predictions, getting people to make testable predictions, and adjusting how much we listen to their future predictions based on how accurate they've been in the past. There's a reason that commentators hate this kind of thing, because their careers are built on making wild predictions and, you know, getting one out of every 20 wild predictions right, and then pointing to that and saying, you see, I called this one out of 20, I called this one right, and then just ignore all the other ones I made. And super forecasting is just the idea that this is something that you can get better at. This is a skill that you can learn, and you can, there are techniques that you can learn. It's not a kind of God-given gift of foresight or anything. It's just learning how to see through the noise or listen through the noise and hear the signal. And, you know, there have been some really good examples of this. And it's always nice because they're not really massively credentialed people. Two people who come to mind are both friends of mine, Saloni Jitani and Jonathan Kitson, who write for, CapEx. And both of whom were tracking the vaccine throughout the year and arguing that compared to what most people thought, a vaccine was much more likely to be sooner rather than later. And I think it's just amazing to see them vindicated and to see that kind of that approach of testing your predictions and putting them out there so that other people can test them being laid out and being so successful. And on the kind of bad side, the flip side of forecasting is the kind of endless people who just made constant contingent wrong predictions about COVID. We've already got mass immunity. T cells will mean that we can't have a second spike. Sweden, suicides have spiked, which it turns out they hadn't. Rising testing means rising case numbers. There is no excess mortality. You know, all these predictions that have been thrown out by very, very prominent and influential people, but then really just they forget about, everybody forgets about as soon as it turns out that they were just plain wrong. And, like I say, there's nothing wrong with being wrong, but if you're consistently wrong, then the rest of us should be adjusting how much we listen to on that basis.
All right. I couldn't agree more with pretty much everything there, Sam. I've got so sick of people snidely on Twitter going, super forecasters, when it also refers to a very specific group of people in Philip Tetlock's Good Judgment Project who are consistently good and adjust their forecast constantly and are the opposite of the kind they imply it's intellectually arrogant to claim you're a super forecaster, whereas the people who are good at it are exactly the opposite of that. Don't claim expertise, have big groups of people they correspond with all the time.
And often non-experts. You know, what's really interesting is that it's not that they're finding PhDs who are absolutely immersed in the current affairs of Afghanistan and so can be really good at predicting civil strife in Afghanistan. It's actually, it turns out, people who tend to be good at this are often very run-of-the-mill, they have very run-of-the-mill lives. You know, they're maybe house husbands or housewives, or, you know, they run a small business in rural Germany or something. And it's the techniques of really trying to look through the wild predictions and look through the kind of the hype that allow them to apparently consistently predict better than average. And that's quite encouraging because it means that maybe others can learn that as well.
Yeah. And I would encourage anyone to go and read Philip Tetlock's book because it's very interesting and it will make you rethink how you approach these kinds of problems as well, I think. So that's super forecasting, which is Sam's idea of the year, which only leaves my own. I guess it's almost like a buzz phrase rather than an idea, but it's social distancing. I just come to absolutely despise this phrase because it sums up all the kind of petty fogging approach to
the corona regulations, which, even though in my non-emotional brain I know are designed to help minimize the spread of the disease and all that, I still just can't help but look at these signs and think there's something really silly about them. And that the phrase itself, am I alone here, guys? It's just a strange phrase. It's not social distancing, it's physical more than anything. And it's just, yeah, I'm just sick to the death of hearing it and can't wait to stop hearing it and seeing signs everywhere saying it.
It always annoys me when jargon kind of becomes commonly accepted and used. Like you say, it doesn't really mean anything. It's not really, I mean, like, I kind of get what people mean by distancing, but that's not really the point, especially if it's given that it's transmitted in an aerosolized way. It's more like indoor avoidance or something, but it's just kind of jargon that's just become, everybody says it without even thinking about it. And yeah, it just feels like we lose a slight bit of meaning in our lives when that happens.
It also conveys, I think, particularly the signs with the kind of 2 meter width arrow, this illusion of technocratic precision to the whole thing. Like, aha, at 2 meters, you'll be safe. Whereas at 1 or 1.5, you might not be. But as you say, Sam, it's all a bit illusory. As with the whole hand washing stuff at the beginning of the pandemic, the more you learn, the more you start to think, actually, why have we been doing all this stuff all along and making such a fuss about it when we hear almost nothing about things like ventilation, outdoor stuff? I remember at the beginning, people, including you, were saying we should be subsidizing heaters outdoors in pub gardens and stuff like that. And we never really heard anything. I think that would have been far more effective than trying to get people indoors and doing things. We should have been facilitating people doing things outdoors where there was evidently less risk. So that's my little corona rant. Right. Well, that leads us, I mean, quite neatly onto our penultimate category is policy of the year. These are pretty much all COVID related, but we'll have to run through these quite quickly because we are short on time now. Alice, do you want to kick us off with another bit of jargon, I think?
Sure. I wish I had one that wasn't COVID related, but it is Wales's firebreak lockdown. It just didn't work. Cases in Wales are higher than they've ever been. You know, at the time, Keir Starmer was saying that we needed one in England. Well, what evidence was that based on? I just have the feeling that all the devolved administrations are just trying to do something slightly stricter, slightly sooner than England, and winds me up. So
I think the whole Welsh response has been absolutely farcical. I mean, in fact, they let pubs open, but then said they couldn't serve alcohol. It was really strange. And then we had all this stuff about whether they let people in from England. And yeah, like you say, differentiation for the sake of it seems to have been the order of the day.
Yeah, exactly. Scotland's the same with the restaurants can open until 6, but can't serve alcohol. I don't know where we got this idea that sort of temperance and Puritanism would somehow get rid of COVID.
Very Scottish, to be fair. It's at least it's return to tradition, at least.
Yeah. It's the Donald Farfrae tendency for any Thomas Hardy fans out there. Emma, yours is probably the policy of the year. Well, I mean, I know that's the category, but it's the one that has probably had the most impact of any of them, rather than just being our favourite.
Well, yeah, I decided not to make a particular value judgment on good policy, bad policy, and just went for the one that probably is going to stick in people's minds, and that is, you know, it's furlough. It didn't really exist in the British system. You know, we didn't really have this idea of furlough before, and now everyone knows what it is. They may not understand necessarily the detail of what the government will pay, won't pay at certain dates, but everyone knows someone who's been on furlough, has been on furlough. And yeah, it's had good and bad. You know, we at the IEA especially earlier in the year, criticised, you know, repeated extensions to the scheme, saying, look, businesses are not going to be valid, not going to be viable at the end of this, that we're at the beginning and the government shouldn't be subsidising wages. But actually, I think now I tend to agree more with Matt Kilcoyne at the ASI of just do it. We've spent so much money at this stage. If the vaccine can be rolled out by Easter, just a little bit more is fine. You know, the additional spending and furlough so far has cost, I think, £43 billion. Is the most up-to-date figures I can find. That's, in normal times, would be an astonishing amount of money. In COVID, you know, it's a lot, but we've spent, you know, hundreds of billions at this stage. So I think whether it turns out to be good or bad in the long run, it's going to be the policy that defines 2020.
Yeah, the fiscal Overton window is sort of shattered in 1,000
pieces. Yes, it hasn't moved. It's legged it.
Like, yeah, 10 billion there, what the hell? Like, we've wasted so much money on test and trace, and it's just kind of the occasional item in the, you know, we talked about the NHS IT cock-up for about 10 years after it happened. Spent more than that on test and trace already, and it doesn't get anything like the coverage. Sam, your policy of the year, I think you've chosen two, one of which we are about to publish a piece this very day on CapEx about, which I like, which is to do with housing, and the other one is your kind of bad policy of the year. So do you want to just quickly run through them?
Yeah, the bad policy, although I personally, in fact, because I personally benefited from it so much, is Eat Out to Help Out. Eat Out to Help Out subsidized people to go to restaurants. The fact that I, a reasonably well-off young urban liver in London, was able to fleece the taxpayer for over £100, I mean, should tell you enough that it's not a very good idea to begin with. But the reason that it's a bad idea, or really the reason that I've chosen it, is that it sums up the completely insane pro-virus approach of the government throughout the year. To be honest, I think pretty much everything the government's done, the Occam's razor approach to understanding what is going on in number 10 right now is that the virus is running the government, and everything the government is doing is the bare minimum that it has to do, because public opinion is really hawkish on COVID. But the government, and I'm just, for in case people can't hear me smiling, I'm kind of joking when I say this, I'm being facetious, but so much of what it has done seems to have been kind of, at least if not intended, to spread the virus, really with no thought whatsoever, and paying people, subsidizing people to crowd inside restaurants, right as everybody was coming back from their holidays in Spain, which brought back a lot of COVID cases, and then just before sending people to schools and universities, by law, to schools. I mean, really just what seems to me to be totally crazy. And you know, I don't blame Eat Out to Help Out for all of the second wave, of course, but I think it certainly contributed, and it sums up a really, really crazy series of decisions that the government made. The good policy is street votes, which is this idea that we should let individual streets vote on how dense they are in terms of housing. And this is potentially going to be in the government's planning reform bill, and I think it could be transformational for a lot of cities. It could really allow much more density, which would be great for local businesses. It would be great for people who rent and for people who want to buy, because it will mean there are more places to buy. And it will be great for existing homeowners, because the value of their properties will rise because they can build more on them. It's a real win-win-win. And if it happens, it could be great. And because in the theme of every single thing I say has to have something to do with COVID, it's worth stressing that number of people per household is a pretty good predictor of how bad COVID outbreaks have been in Europe. And, you know, one reason, for example, that Sweden's outbreak wasn't as bad as a lot of other countries, despite not having the same kinds of restrictions that it probably should have and that its neighbours had.
Yeah, it's been interesting, actually. A lot of the ways different countries have responded to the virus sometimes have seemed to be almost regardless of what their government has done, and has just been down to demographics. Or Italy, say, lots of old people living with younger relatives definitely didn't help them in the early stages. Right. And my policy of the year, which has been in no way influenced by the fact that I am in the middle of moving house, is the stamp duty holiday. I would just like to encourage anyone at the Treasury who is listening to this podcast to extend it, because otherwise it's going to cost me loads of money. Jokes aside, I think this has been a policy that's been coming for a long time. We've been lobbying fiercely for it. It's a crap tax. Literally, I've never heard anyone come out with a decent argument in favour of it beyond that isn't just it raises a lot of money. Well, there are infinite ways you can raise money that aren't anything like as damaging as this. Bit of a CapEx hobby horse, but yeah. So the stamp duty holiday, it's given us a little window into a world of much lower stamp duty, and I think, and you know, transactions are up. The housing market, even in a pandemic, has been pretty buoyant. So, you know, just imagine what it will do when all these restrictions are lifted. So I really, really hope they carry on with that. And reform our other property taxes, like council tax being the obvious candidate. So hopefully something good will come out of the of COVID in terms of the long-term kind of policy landscape. Right, we're gonna finish off with our
a quick run through from everyone. So we've got reasons to be fearful, of which I'm sure there are plenty for 2021, and reasons to be cheerful. So we'll start with fearful. Emma?
I mean, your last answer leads me nicely into my reasons to be fearful, which is that even in a pandemic, house prices haven't fallen. Yes. They have continued to rise in London. They are rising exactly as fast as they were rising before the pandemic. I mean, I understand that now where people live is even more important to them. You know, it was important before, but now, I mean, all four of us appear to be in our houses recording this. We work from home most, if not all of the time. So you value your physical space more, and that's completely fine. But as someone trapped by the UK's utterly terrible housing policy, and even today, you know, the government have announced they've scrapped their algorithm to build more houses in the south and London, even in a pandemic, housing and home ownership is no more affordable to me than it was before. But my reason to be cheerful, and this is a bit of a trying to put a spin on a terrible situation, is that I have a very faint hope that possibly the catastrophic disaster that has been government and state handling, not just in the UK, but pretty much everywhere, of a pandemic will sow the seeds of a sort of a liberalism, libertarianism, possibly, in some of the population, that they will be less keen to suggest that actually the government is the solution to all of our problems. Because as 2020 has proved, the government isn't the solution to very much.
All right. Yeah, I mean, I share that hope, although I would say hope rather than kind of optimism.
I was more realistic about it in sort of April than I am now. It has waned over 2020.
I think people just blame the Tories rather than government in general. And I think that the sort of lefty argument of, well, we just need to fund things, quote unquote, properly, will always have a certain appeal to it. Okay. Alice, reasons to be fearful?
Yeah, well, so mine are kind of the opposite to what Emma was saying. I'm worried about sort of COVID creep creating an ever less liberal state. I'm worried that people will start to say, well, if you could lock everyone in their houses, put us all under house arrest for the pandemic, why not for other threats? Why not for climate change, for example? And I was particularly worried by what Jonathan Sumption told me when I interviewed him for this podcast, which was that when the government starts using fear to coerce people, freedom dies. So that was my not very jolly.
Freedom dying, that's your fear, okay. And you're cheerful?
My reason to be cheerful is that next year cannot possibly be as bad as this one.
Just don't say that out loud.
The most Eeyore-ish reason to be cheerful I've ever heard.
I'm happy to be held to account for my forecasting abilities.
I think it could be worse. I mean, you know, it could have all the same problems with less of the public and sort of public adherence or fiscal firepower to deal with it. Although, obviously, we've got the vaccine.
Although I did see a story yesterday that apparently the UK is at greater risk of floods in January and February. So that'll be a nice way to kick off the year.
Is that the same every year or is it just this year?
Yeah, apparently it's worse this year.
Oh, good.
Somehow. It's going to rain more.
Wonderful.
So.
Fantastic. Great. Right. Sam, your reasons to be fearful is one sort of close to home and sort of day job.
I'm sad to say that this is something that's going to affect us all. And this is the huge consensus that the technology sector needs to be regulated. And just in the past few weeks, we've had the European Union, the UK government, the House of Representatives in the US all come out with plans to regulate tech. And, you know, it's a shame because I don't think it's really going to work. I don't think it's going to bring about the outcomes that people want, which let's be charitable. I think people would like more startups, people would like more innovation, people would like more competition in these markets. I don't think regulation ever really gets you those kinds of things. And I have to say, when it comes to Europe and the UK, I think the problems that we have are not to do with regulation of tech or even competition in tech. They're to do with, you know, access to capital, to do with migration and the difficulty of bringing talented people into the UK, to do with land use planning and the costs of setting up a business. You know, it's a sort of nuts and bolts policy items that, you know, you can tinker around a tech regulation all you like, but it's not going to get you the next Google if you don't change the ingredients. ingredients for innovation. And I worry that actually tying these companies' hands, they're really innovative companies. They're you know, we'll talk about in my reason to be cheerful, some of the innovations that have come out of them. But it's just a shame that people have this, I think, very old-fashioned view of, maybe old-fashioned is the wrong word, they have a wrong view of innovation as something that only startups can do and that big companies are incapable of. And if you don't think that's true, and I don't think that's true, then tying these companies' hands could be really damaging to innovation with no real commensurate benefit.
Mm-hmm. I would also encourage you to read Sam's article about why we shouldn't break up Facebook on CapEx, which makes a very compelling case. And your reasons to be cheerful is kind of on the same note, as you said.
It's the classic race, arms race between government kind of trying to make markets worse and markets often beating government and becoming and just producing good things and producing benefits to people. Because, you know, in Tyler Cowen's words, the great American economist, you know, maybe the great stagnation, maybe this era that he's identified, I don't really agree with him, but he's identified that sort of innovation that's promoted economic growth has slowed down over the past sort of 30 years. And he sort of thinks that maybe that's over. And, you know, in biotech, for example, you know, looks as if we're on the cusp of not just developing vaccines for COVID, but things like the flu, the common cold, malaria. CRISPR allows us to do gene editing in an incredible way. DeepMind has solved the protein folding problem. And in a kind of more direct way, I'm absolutely flabbergasted by the success of Apple's M1 chips. Apple's for a long time been by far the leading company in semiconductors and chips, but its desktop computer and laptop computer chips that it's released have been far, far, far better than those of its competition. And, you know, that's Intel, Qualcomm, and so on. Kind of amazing to think that the largest company on earth, very, very vertically integrated, lots of money, lots of resources, is still at the cutting edge by far of innovation in this kind of area. And it gives me a lot of hope for the things that other businesses, big and small, can achieve in the next few years.
All right. Thank you very much, Sam. And the final one from me. Okay, so reasons to be fearful. I've got the government's spending addiction. So I'm concerned that not just on COVID, but on almost everything, the answer from government is just to borrow more, spend more for the state to direct everything, whether it's levelling up or responding to Brexit or whatever it may be. The emphasis always seems to be on what the government can spend and not on private enterprise or on long-term reform or any of those things. So that's me being at my Eeyore-ish. And my reason to be cheerful is a little bit more abstract, but it's that because of all the restrictions we've had, people have been forced to innovate. Lots of people have taken to different working patterns, which I think by no means great for everyone. But for a lot of people, they've meant you can work from home. You can spend more time with your family if you like that kind of thing. You can spend less of your time commuting. I think for a lot of people, that will mean that the future hopefully will be a bit happier, a little bit less sort of rat racy. And also it has the potential to solve to an extent some of our big, long, deep-seated problems like Emma mentioned with housing. If people are able to kind of work from wherever they want, then there becomes less of a sort of pile in certain very overheated areas. So this is my slightly Panglossian take on the year. I don't necessarily think it'll come true, but I hope it will. So it only remains for me to thank very much our panelists, Emma, Sam, Alice. Wish you all a very merry, appropriately bubbled Christmas. And we will see you again for the CapEx podcast in 2021. So thanks very much.
Thanks. Happy Christmas.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.